We're cutting in fairly deeply to the meaning of life and truth. I don't mean to get too philosophical, but in our society, you know, we're rather, as compared to the general populations of the world, we're rather sophisticated people. We're all conversant with things like psychology and things of that type that, many parts of the world, the average person isn't even conversant with. But as I've said before, if I don't get sort of down to the nitty-gritty of some of these things, then you get them from other sources that may not be as sensitive to the Christian concept of this matter. Sometimes I have to get a little heavy, and we've been talking in the past about problems of Greek wisdom, sophistry, or the sophists. The main thing in talking about that was only to show the contrast between the simplicities of what the Bible has to say about the essence of life and what the Greeks talked about. Because they, if you think I'm a little deep sometimes or over the head, try reading Plato or Socrates or some of these other people, and you'll find that they're a little more complex in their statements. But truth ought to be simple, because truth ought to be available to everyone. So my task is to take perhaps complex subjects and make them simple. Now we're in the second chapter of 1 Corinthians. Remember last week we said that when Paul spoke of not coming in the excellency of wisdom or words, that he was really talking not about excellency in the sense of well-chosen words and phrases or rhetoric or something. That's not what he was talking about. He was not putting down the idea of speaking well. What he meant was the supra-rational. Now you see, rational means reasonable, and we all have our frequencies on which we function with reason. We all think we're reasonable. Everybody who talks thinks they're reasonable. If you don't think so, try arguing with somebody and trying to prove to them that they're not reasonable, but you are. We all like to think we're reasonable. The rationale or the reason of one group is different than the reason of another. I think, for example, men tend more toward mathematical reason or symbolic logic or mathematical logic, whereas women tend more toward abstract logic. And that's a nice way to put it. If you're not really coming through on the same frequency with your wife, gentlemen, just say, well, obviously your reasoning is an abstract type of logic. You don't ever tell her she's not reasonable. The impact of what we're saying here is that reason or rationale or logic has to do with putting in an organized sequence one's ideas. Mathematical logic would be that 2 plus 2 equals 4. Abstract logic, which is used often by your wives, gentlemen, is that 2 plus 2 doesn't always equal 4 if 2 has in it more than its normal share of things. So the 2 plus 2 to the second power does not equal 4. See? So anyway, what I'm really saying is logic or reason simply means putting things in an order, in an organized sequence of ideas. Now, the human brain functions in a process called reason. The brain has gathered a good deal of data, and we try to organize that data in a way that makes sense. But not everybody is able to do that. Not everybody is able to outline or to present ideas in an organized way. That doesn't mean they're not smart. It just means that they have a different way of thinking. Once again, if you're arguing with someone, you can just say, well, apparently you have a different way of thinking than I do. But don't ever tell them they're unreasonable. Now, Paul here mentions a word that means supra-reasonable. not super reasonable, which would mean very, very reasonable, but supra-reasonable or supra-rational. Those are two synonyms. Reasonable and rational are pretty synonymous. So supra-rational means something beyond normal wisdom or normal reason. So that in God's economy, God's way of reasoning, he probably doesn't even use digits. You know, 2 + 2 = 4 is only a Mack truck way of lumbering along in the doldrums of human thought. But God goes way beyond that, and his powers of rationale are way above it. Paul is saying that he is not coming with supra-rational words of human origin or human wisdom. That is, words in which the Greek words were an effort to extract the meaning of life from a realm that their minds were not able to really grasp. In other words, the knowledge that a human being can acquire to himself can only be in the nature of natural logic or human things. Thus, all of our efforts to decide the origin of the universe must fail because we look at it from human reason. All right, now Paul is saying, I'm not coming to you with ethereal ideas from the stratosphere of the effort of human wisdom. I'm coming to you rather in the demonstration of the Spirit and of power. And when he says, I judge not to know anything among you except Jesus and this one crucified, as I said to you last week, he was not saying he went around as an ignoramus, not reading or looking at anything but spiritual ideas. In a sense, he was saying that he was not going to follow the Greek philosophers into the realm or the doldrums of human logic in an effort to grasp the meaning of the supernatural. I hope that you can grasp what I'm saying. To Paul, the essential meaning of the universe is tied in with the crucified Christ. That's perhaps a simpler way to put this. To Paul, the knowledge of the universe, the essence of it, was tied in to the crucifixion or to Christ, the crucified one, and not into the realm of human efforts to gain knowledge of the supernatural. Now, why, we may ask ourselves, why would this be so pivotal? The reason that it is pivotal is that in the one grand act of sacrifice of himself, Christ made a statement about the realities of life, that is, the realism of death and brutality versus what might pass for life in human fantasy, where people never have to face reality. For example, a person could have lived in the society of Corinth a very nice life, perhaps been in some Greek villa, or at least had a very tranquil, idyllic life. In fact, you take Greek village where they have their flocks and their fishermen and various ways of sustaining themselves. You have a simple, quiet little village. In fact, this last trip, perhaps one of the most idyllic villages or towns was Mykonos. Such a gracious, simple kind of a Greek town, whitewashed, everything whitewashed, even the streets were white. You'd had the stones and even the mortar between was whitewashed. You'd go over with a brush, whitewash the streets, which were walkways, they didn't have any automobiles in those streets between the houses. A very nice little village nestled in the hills of the island, It was idyllic in every way. Maybe we ought to get that. Dwayne, in the trunk of the car is that little brown briefcase that has all my stuff from the trip in it. I'll pass around a picture of Mykonos because I want you to see that. What an idyllic little town it is. And what my point is, that you could live in one of those villages all your life and never really confront anything too distressing or too serious, you see. Oh, you've got, yeah, that's it. You can pass that around. That's Mykonos. Beautiful little harbor. We ate dinner in a little restaurant that looked into the out over the little town. And it's just so nice. And you could go live your life that way and never really confront anything too brutish or serious or whatever. But the crucifixion, the cross of Christ, shatters the illusions about life as an idyllic thing. If nothing else does, the cross of Christ does. So when Paul says, I determined only to know, I determined that when I'm looking at the meaning of the world, I have to start with the cross. I have to focus on the cross of Christ because that pulls us quickly into the brutal realities of life. And the brutal reality of life is death. And the brutal reality of death is brutish death. It's the iniquity of man come to the full when he will batter the Son of God in that respect, in his physical form. The cross makes a statement that sin must be confronted, that this evil world must be seen for its essential ingredient. The essential ingredient of mankind on the earth, says Paul, is evil. The religious scientists and others try to say the essence of life is good. People are good. You have to be pretty blind to say that, generally speaking, all people on earth are good. There's just too much brutality in the world, too much rottenness and so forth. But that doesn't mean that man should be abandoned, that mankind should be abandoned. Essentially, when you say, what is the meaning of life, instead of talking about the logos and eternal ideals and all these sorts of things, he says, talk about death, talk about evil, talk about the cross. Then you're talking about the essence of life. Goodness and niceness or niceties of life are passing. We've all experienced that. You have a period of time when everything is nice, and then you have a period of time where everything is not nice. You know? You get along with people at one point, and all of a sudden, people are not getting along in a given situation. Little things come up to spoil it. Always there's something spoiling things for you. A baby is a lovely thing until it starts screaming all night long. It has a way of spoiling the illusions. Okay, so Paul says, don't look at ethereal words, high-sounding phrases about eternal idea. If you want to talk about the meaning of life, look at the cross. Here's a man who came only to do good, and walked among men and mankind in grace and love and all that. What'd they do? They battered him and hung him on a cross. Talk about that, then you'll be talking about reality. But it also makes a statement about the redemptive process that God was willing to sacrifice his son, let us say, for the world's needs. And God was willing to go to whatever length was necessary to redeem the world. If you want to know the reality of God, it isn't in a word, but in a deed. Plato says the reality of God is a word, logos, an idea. Paul says the reality of God is a deed of mercy and love to redeem mankind. So the cross says that man essentially is evil and headed for death, but God has made provision for his life. Now see, this is what is meant by the statement, I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and this one crucified. All the rest is philosophical blarney or baloney. Philosophical idiocy. So Paul says next, I came in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. Or I was among you in weakness and fear and much trembling. That shatters another illusion. That shatters the illusion that when we become really, really, really filled with the Spirit, we no longer have to worry or be anxious or be anything but victorious and shouting hallelujah. That was not Paul's attitude. I think Paul, to most people of that persuasion, would have to have another dip. I can imagine someone coming to him and saying, what you really need, Paul, is to be filled with the Spirit. You see, because you're anxious, you're worrying. I think that's a tremendous statement because it puts us right down on the same, or puts Paul right down the same level with us. And I've used the verse in 2 Corinthians 7 where Paul says in verse 5, without were fightings, within were fears. Nevertheless, God who comforts those that are in any trouble comforted us by the coming of Titus. What was the comfort to Paul? A rather earthly, fleshly comfort. That his partner, companion in the work, came to him. He was troubled because it wasn't there. Just like a parent may be troubled at night about a young person that hasn't come in on time. You don't all maybe know that yet. Some of you women, your children are not ready for that yet. Well, there are other things that may trouble you. But if, for example, let's say your child has wandered off and you don't know quite where the child is, well, what are you going to say? Hallelujah, victory in Jesus? Or are you going to worry about it? Well, you're going to be troubled. As I had to say to one young man who was very concerned about my thought that it wasn't a sin to worry, I said, well, maybe you're just not old enough to worry yet. When you've been around a little bit, you know that life has its stingers. Life has its stingers, you know, and you get hurt. It isn't that you don't expect it or you don't, you're afraid of it, but you get hurt. Like a man out on the football field. He knows the chances are pretty good that before the end of the game, he's going to get hurt. That doesn't stop him from playing the game. He doesn't run over to the bench and sit down and cry. But he's going to get hurt, and he doesn't necessarily want to get hurt. He doesn't go into the game thinking, oh, great, I'm going to get hurt this game, and I know everything's going to be all right because we're going to win the game anyway. No, he gets hurt, and he doesn't like to be hurt. And Christians get hurt, and they don't like to be hurt. And it causes distress. Man, if you're anything like Paul, you're going to find times that you're distressed. And if you think that you're going to live above that, you're going to be more distressed than ever because you're not going to make it. And I still hear people at the age of 50 and 60 and 70 saying, well, we really aren't supposed to worry. Then how come you're worrying? Well, I'm still human. Well, then quit talking about it for 50 years. We shouldn't worry. I think that's a very glorious statement. Paul says, I was with you in fear and trembling and weakness. And then he went on to say that my word and my message was not in the persuasive wisdom of words or human words, but in the show of the Spirit and of power, in order that your faith may not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Now we come to another level of the message, the meaning of the message. Now can you imagine how many different ways of thinking there are in this room? See, when I make a statement and the statement sounds logical to me, but it may not sound logical to anyone else. I may think it's a great statement. I may want to put it on a sign and hang it on the wall above the kitchen sink. See? But I may be more impressed with the statement than you are. Because why? Well, you come with different words. A letter came in that which had a sentence that was hard to figure out until you came to the arrow that went from one word and pointed back three or four words behind and picked that word up and put it at the end of the sentence. Then you read it that way and you understand the sentence. But I couldn't figure out why they put the word that far ahead in the first place. But anyway, it's what they call dyslexia, where you get words mixed up. And I've done, in teaching, you run into that quite a bit, where people, they get a sentence garbled because they've got a mental block there, and they put words in the wrong sequence. Now, that's the way maybe my words come out to you, dyslexia. I think it's a great sermon, and you're saying it's dyslexia, Each word is, you come to it with your own experience. And what may sound like a perfectly normal word to me may not sound the same to you. I think I told you the illustration of a woman that came up to me after a meeting very incensed, very angry with me because I had used a word that she was taught was not proper. I had said niggardly, and she thought I meant in terms of the blacks. And that she was horrified that I should use that word. Well, I hope you all understand niggardly means stingily, something like that. Like your husband sometimes when you want money for a new dress or something. I'm illustrating, that's a rather extreme illustration of it, but it happens in a lot of other words. I may think you understand the word and you don't understand it at all in the way I understand it. But now comes the power of the Spirit to bring the word to you the way you understand it. Now, this was the great miracle of Pentecost. It says everyone heard in their own tongue. Now, if you want to extend that a little bit or expand it a little bit and think in terms of even all of us who speak English or American, rather, I think English might be embarrassed to have us call this English, but we all speak American here with generous sprinklings of corn pone and Kentucky bourbon. We have our colloquialisms and our slanguage. And it doesn't sound always that noble to people that hear it. But it's Americanese is what it is. We are really speaking a different language often, but you have to hear it. I say the word the way I understand it. The Spirit of God has got to take that word and bring it to you in the way you understand it. So it may get spun around in the telling. If the Spirit is ministering to you through it. It's difficult to see how everyone in the room could understand the same thing in the same way and get helped by it, except that it gets turned around and comes to you in your own understanding of things. The Spirit gives you that understanding. I had a young man with me at a meeting in another city who came for the first time to the meeting. He was having a lot of trouble with drugs. In this meeting that I had, there was a Spanish gentleman who was had a great heart for God, and I would say he had the gift of faith or of healing or whatever. But anyway, we prayed together for this young man. The only thing was, this fellow prayed in Spanish. Because that was his native language, and he could speak it better, you see. Now, the interesting thing is this. The young man, listening to him pray, understood what he was saying, but he had never had any Spanish. I understood what he was saying, and I've only had 10 years of it, but that still doesn't mean anything when you go over to Barcelona or something. You still can't speak Spanish. But see, the Spirit witnessed to us beyond language. And that's what has to happen here. The Spirit of God has to witness or minister to you beyond language. And that's why Paul says, my speech and preaching was not in words of wisdom or wisdom words, but in the expression of the Spirit and of power. But try to repeat it. Let us say that you've had some word that has come to you in a meeting and it's been a help to you. Now you're going to repeat it to your husband or wife at home or to some friend. Well, what happens to it? It's all dyslexia again. No matter how wise or how expert or superb words might be, I'm not saying mine are that, but however they might be, still, if we're going to get anything out of it, the Holy Spirit has to take that word and bring it to you. That's why these meetings have any degree of profit to them, whatever, because the Spirit takes the word and in his own way ministers to you. But he says, in order that your faith may not be in wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Now, one of the problems with a lot of the excessive expression in a meeting, I mean, if I'm talking to you here, and in some groups, it might be assumed that if I'm saying something that's really important, everybody will say amen, you know. Or they'll have some outward expression of it. That's not necessarily the Spirit at all. Because when the word comes to you, you may not know even what to do with it. Everything that's going on in this process is invisible, unseen, touching the inner strings of the Spirit, and may do more for you in your spirit than your mind is even comprehending. You see that? Your mind may not even be comprehending a lot of what I'm saying, yet the Spirit is putting it there, and later it'll come to you. I've had that mentioned many times. Someone will say, well, I didn't quite get it that night, but later on it came back to me, and I saw what it was all about. The Spirit lays it into your spirit, and later on it comes out in different ways with meaningful force. So he says that your faith may not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. And once again, I must caution you that the deepest things going on in your life, not just in these meetings, but in every aspect of it, the deepest thing going on in your life is not always on the surface. It may not give very much outward evidence, whatever. And you may think you're not learning or you're not growing and things are all down the hill, and yet the Spirit is working anyway. The benefit and blessing in your spirit tonight from the word that is given may not come through any kind of a mental, rational process where you have absorbed it with your mind. You may not have absorbed this with your mind at all, but the Spirit has absorbed it. And it has had its effect in your life. And you may not, for the life of you, be able to remember next week what I said tonight. I don't even remember what I said or always where I was at. So how can I expect you? And one of the absurd things, I think, in ministry, in preaching, is to have a man up there with an outline. If he can't even remember it, how does he expect the people to remember it? It's a little different slant to this thing of ministry. The Spirit is doing in your spirit what he wants to do tonight. The word is communicated outwardly, but it is taken then and distributed to you each in your spirits. And the activities of your life as you go from day to day in your work and your life, those activities are also agents of the Spirit shaping up your life. And if those circumstances are a little rough right now, it's part of the chiseling as the Lord is making the artwork, the sculpture. Now I'm going to conclude this one line. He said, but we speak wisdom among the perfect. Now, what does that mean? Now, do you think I can honestly sit here and say to you that I'm speaking wisdom among the perfect? Everybody who thinks you're perfect, you know, I'm not going to even ask. If some smart aleck will raise his hand. If I had to minister to only to the perfect, I'd have a good long rest. I'd have 2 6-month vacations twice a year. But what does he mean by it? Well, the word there translated perfect, teleios, means those who are geared toward a given end. Telos, the Greek word telos, has to do with the end of things, the purpose, the meaning, the ultimate end of things. So you could say the telos of society is the glorification of God's creatures. That's the end in view. So he is speaking wisdom among those who are part of the fellowship of the purposeful, people who have an end, a meaning, a purpose to life. We are all caught up in the process of God's divine purpose in the universe. See? All of you who are here tonight are in that company of those who have identified themselves with the divine purpose in the world or in the universe. So his kind of wisdom is to those who are in that process and not to those who are merely trying to immortalize Greek culture. I saw the immortalization of Greek culture on the Acropolis in 1,000 pieces and fragments. That might be the symbol of the ultimate, the summum bonum of Greek culture is on the Acropolis in Athens, with magnificent buildings and magnificent sculptures of God, of the deities and so forth. All of that represents the superb essence of Greek culture, but all of it was in ruins. Rather than being linked with the purposes of the Greek society, which was to magnify Greece, Paul was speaking to those whose purposes were linked with God to the glorification of his creatures, his creation, in the universe, ultimately for God's own purposes. So we speak wisdom among those who are identified with the eternal purposes of God. Well, I think we're going to speak no more.